This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
The Scotland Outdoors Podcast from BBC Radio Scotland with Mark Stephen and Helen Needham.
Hello, and thanks very much for choosing to listen to this podcast. I'm Mark Stephen. In this edition, Helen Needham and I are in the Great Glen visiting an old friend and colleague, Penny Latton. Penny used to be a BBC programme maker, a very good one, but in January 2020 she was diagnosed with breast cancer and went on to have a mastectomy. This coincided with her and her family moving to a particularly beautiful part of Scotland. Now, the cancer treatment, the surgery, was predictably rough, but Penny said she was amazed at how much she found the landscape, things like birds and animals, even the wild flowers surrounding her home, to be really helpful with her recovery. Now, we thought that was an interesting idea, nature as healer or co-healer, and we asked if we could come and talk to her about it. Almost inevitably, our chat began with all of us climbing up a hill above Loch Ness. This is a mixture match sort of day. Where we're standing, you can hear all the birdsong and the sun is shining and there's huge amounts of gorse. I mean, great billowing explosions of yellow blossoms. Fantastic. But further down the loch, Loch Ness, it's snowing, which is just washing out all of the colour. It is a beautiful, stunning location. You are a lucky git. But this is ridiculous.
We've been here just over a year and I think still every day I come out and think, this is ridiculous. Mm-hmm. You know, and I've fallen in love with this landscape so much and I'm forming kind of stories and memories around it the whole time. And I've sort of labelled it ahead of us just there, up above the bracken, is what I call Badgerlands. Mm-hmm. And we're going to wander up a bit over the top of it now, because this time last year, we started exploring the woods on the hillside that rises up above Loch Ness and found lots of badger sets.
The reason that we've come here to explore your particular landscape, Penny, is because it's not only been a source of fascination for you just becoming acquainted with it since you moved here, but it's actually formed more of a story and more of a healing landscape perhaps for you because of your own personal situation that you've been going through.
We moved here 2 weeks after I'd had major surgery for cancer, breast cancer, and then it was also the first week of lockdown, the first lockdown. So I guess by chance or by circumstance, I ended up physically sort of locked into this landscape and we weren't going anywhere anyway. So it's become so associated with the healing process and the stages of me getting better.
At what stage did you start to notice your surroundings again? Because I'm guessing, obviously, but surely the surgery itself really draws you in yourself, makes you look internally.
It is a massive assault on you. There's no doubt about it, and it has huge ripple effects, and it's very long-lasting. But where we live, Mark, I mean, you've seen it for yourself. Mm. I step out the door. How can you not notice what is around you. That's an assault of a very different kind on your senses, on everything you see. So I think that I couldn't not notice it. And I think that's been really important, because it would be really easy to fold in on yourself when you've gone through something like a mastectomy, to absolutely just mine into all the detail of how that feels, which is really complicated. But I love the fact that in living in a landscape that offers so much, it can't help but pull you out, pull you away from that. And it becomes a balance, but it's also a place that I found I can go and move in and be in and process that internal dealing with cancer, mastectomy, everything that that's meant. It's given me a place to work through that. When I came here, I became so super sensitive to everything that was around me that rather than not being able to see it, I saw all of it. Mm-hmm. And it became overwhelmingly precious. And actually what was hard was not seeing it, but now able to cope with sort of wanting to hold it all really tightly to me. And it felt fragile because I was fragile, wafer thin.
You've written about it as well. And you've written a bit about actually making it down to the loch. Because I suppose that's another thing, actually, recovering within the landscape, that you have these landmarks, literally, don't you, where you can gauge your progress.
You do. And I remember when we were first here and I thought, one day I'll be able to walk to the bottom of the field below the house and back up. And that will be a stage. That will be a landmark. And, you know, one day I'll be able to walk up the hill as we are now. And in fact, just walk up the hill as we are now. And now I don't think about it. So it shows how far I've come. So you're right. The whole landscape forms waymarkers on that journey to recovery all the time.
Well, let's hear an extract from your journal down by the loch side.
B helps me sit. And while I quietly cry with gratitude for just being alive, she delights in hurling gravel at the water, loving the sound it makes. She leaps and dances on the stones, and I capture her on my phone. It's a joyous photo, bursting with life, head flung back with laughter, hair trailing, arms wide. I look at the photo again and again. Something in it makes me want to spill over. It's at once utterly lovely and just all too much. I'm becoming increasingly aware of my tendency to weep. I try to pin down what the problem is. I mean, we live in the most extraordinary place, surrounded by a landscape which fills me up in every way. This is our dream. We live in paradise, and I'm surrounded by people I love and who love me back. What's wrong with me? I think I'm almost overwhelmed by how amazing everything is, and I'm so scared of losing it all. I'm waiting for the bubble to burst. Cancer burst my bubble, totally out of left field, like a random car crash. And now I'm waiting for the next car crash to happen. All this beauty around me feels so fragile. I start to be so scared of losing everything that everything makes me cry. Walking to the loch in the evening, the reflection of the castle opposite, even birdsong, everything. I feel simultaneously overwhelmingly grateful for all of it. But at the same time, the cancer makes me so aware that at any minute, it could all be taken away. And the more I look at this as an idea, the more I realise that it has hijacked my life. My cancer has given me a fear. A friend who's also recovering from cancer calls by, and I tell him how I'm feeling. He tells me to expect it won't go away for a while, if ever. He says, I will forever be aware of the fragility of life.
This business is about landmarks or way markers, you know, points that you actually hit and achieve and move past. It's worthwhile putting, I think, put this into context. You are now, and you were before your illness, as fit as a butcher's dog, racing on your bike, all sorts of things. So to go from that to suddenly thinking, can I make it down to the bottom of the field? That's a big jump.
Yeah, it's a really big jump. And it's still raw, Mark, because even you saying that brings up a wash of emotion. It's a thing I really struggle with. And I still struggle with it. Trying to set myself realistic targets, realistic landmarks or waymarks in my recovery when they're so different to what my old goals and success was built on. It's fantastically difficult and I get so frustrated with it. I've just started trying to cycle on my road bike again. Mm-hmm. And I went out and we did 30 miles. We cycled around the Beauty Firth. Now, in the past, I might not have bothered to do that because I wouldn't have thought it was far enough. And this time, it might as well have been 300 miles. My body hated it. And it was so slow and so hard. And my back's been in a huff ever since because I have problems with my back post my reconstruction, which I had from my mastectomy. And I've just had this wrestle where I keep thinking, God, it was only 30 miles for Pete's sake. And I'm trying to kind of constantly recalibrate what success looks like, what an achievement looks like. That's I think, one of the hardest things for me in all this is, and I really rage against it, that I've changed so much.
You did a lot. We're talking hundreds and hundreds of miles in the craziest of places on the bike.
Yeah, it's so funny because I didn't see myself as doing a lot. It's funny how you view yourself.
Well, we thought about getting your psychiatric help, seriously. Yeah.
Not the first person who said that, but it might not be for
in
cycling.
Many, many contexts.
Funny people keep saying that. Yeah, I think you don't necessarily step outside of yourself and see it, do you? I just did what felt good and what felt, you know, what was in keeping with actually all the people around me doing it too. I've got an awful lot of friends who do much more daft stuff and cycle further in more bonkers places than I ever have. I think I'm pretty low key with all this. I think that the difficult stuff is clearly I'm made up in my head of someone who likes to achieve in certain ways and achieve certain things, and trying not to compare yourself to the past, I think is the toughest bit of all this. It's like you have to build a wall that says, okay, that was then and it was great, and this is now and this is great. And I do a real big piece of work in my head trying to be really positive about it and find ways of dealing with it. So, for example, I was writing recently about the first time I cycled up Essex Hill outside of Inverness. And the first time I cycled up Essex Hill, which is about, I don't know, maybe it's a 3-mile hill, but it's a well-known climb up out the city. And the first time I did it, back when I was first cycling, I literally, my aim was to climb the hill, and then I went home again. I went, whee, all down the hill, happy as anything with myself. That was my 6-mile cycle done, and it felt great. And I keep saying to myself, look, remember how that felt, how that only 3 miles or only 6 miles or only that one hill actually felt like I won a watch. You know, it was brilliant. And I'm trying to find that again. I'm trying to find that, come on, you can feel good with these small steps. But it is easier to feel good about small steps when it's not steps you've taken before.
Yeah.
And the problem is, I've taken these steps on the bike before. The bike is the real problem. It causes me more kind of churning.
Well, let's hear a bit of the journal where you talk about embracing the e-bike.
Cheating. Eating breakfast at my friend Bruce and Joe's bar, Joe suggested I have a quick spin round the block on her electric bike. It seemed a serendipitous suggestion. Earlier in the week, I'd caught up with another friend, Al, who'd suggested I come and have a try of some e-bikes they got to help people recovering from cancer. Then he said, I wish I'd got mine sooner. It's changed everything. I wanted to say no. I wanted to push the idea of sitting on that bike away. Wanted to sink into my feeling that it would be cheating. But with Al's words so fresh in my head, I gave in and I gave Joe's bike a go. So now, only hours later, here we were in the car driving to the bike shop to buy an electric bike. I lean my head against the window and cry. Why does this feel so much like defeat? This bike will allow us to get back out cycling together, to share something we love. I can stop feeling so sad each Saturday when I watch David, my partner, head off with the cycle club. Now I'll be able to join him. With any luck, the e-bike will allow me to cycle fast enough to comfortably keep up. Because I've been worrying that even when I can get on my bike without my body buckling, I'll be so unfit and slow that riding with me will be torture. And once I'm fit enough, well enough, I can turn off the power. But every time I picture myself on an e-bike, I flinch. There's no getting round it. It feels like I've failed, that I'm accepting that this is as good as I can get, that I'm stuck at this point. It hurts so much, and I feel so angry again that this has happened to me. I hate this disease so much. I want to hit out at it, pummel it, show it how furious I am at it stealing great chunks of who I am. Maybe it's because I'm coming up against something I used to do so much of that it feels more difficult. I find it so hard to push away the memory of my being able to cycle many miles. I know that by comparison, now, I come up so very short. This new bike will force me to confront what I was once capable of, force me to face myself in the mirror. But I also know to sit around waiting to be well enough to cycle is also conceding some kind of defeat to my cancer. So I dry my face on my sleeve, take a breath, and follow David into the shop to buy a way of moving forward. Pick the easiest of landscapes to recover in, really.
Yeah, it's always up, isn't it?
It's up and there's not very well-defined paths, but that's because it's sort of private too.
Yeah, because this path's actually got the burn almost running right through the middle of it, isn't it? But it's
you
lush.
You youngsters just carry on, I'll catch up eventually, don't worry.
So lush!
It's beautiful. You know, sunlight's coming through the trees and it's just hitting this track of moss in front of us. And it's a sort of really, almost like painful viridian green. Up there, deer.
Oh, yeah.
In the trees.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, it's a few of them.
Is it goats?
No, it's deer.
Just deer?
Yeah, they work their way down the hillside each night. Uh-huh. And then they come and nibble on my garden.
Not that bother.
And if we get there, we'll have words.
Yeah. That'll be why they're running away. They've seen you before.
Oh, it's just magic here, isn't it? Look at the way the light falls on the trees.
There's something almost cathedral-like about woods.
I think it's because it draws your eye up.
Yeah.
these, you know, you're drawn up to the light. Uh-huh. You're looking up to the light. And it's that same thing in a cathedral where your eye can't help but look up and rise to the heavens.
And it's interesting in medieval design that we sort of come up from pillars and then spread out like the branches of a tree, holding the roof up. It's almost as if they were mimicking the effect.
You touched on honesty earlier. And I'd like to talk more about that, because that's something when you've been through a life-threatening situation that becomes especially relevant.
Yeah, honesty, it's an interesting one, because when I did put the journaling out there and let people read it, and I'd written masses, but the response to it was very much, wow, thank you for being so honest. And, you know, I'm so touched by your honesty, or oh, I'm really moved by honesty. And honesty kept coming back as this refrain. And it genuinely had never occurred to me to write with anything other than honesty. Why are we afraid of being honest? Why is it so notable when someone is honest? But I think there is stuff in there. There is, and I think when someone is honest, our response to it is to see it as something really quite precious and rare. It did make me realise latterly that it's not something that is always easy for us to do. I think probably through the experience of having had cancer and what that does to you in terms of feeling, I don't know, life needs to be lived and not worried about so much, undoubtedly something unlocked, and part of that was no fear of being honest. And actually that brings to mind something else that I thought about and wrote about. And it's been triggered by us coming up here, because we've come up to what I call Badgerlands and we're in amongst the birches. I love it up here. You feel like choice has been ripped from you when you get a very sudden cancer diagnosis. You don't really have a choice with how it's tackled. I mean, you may have some bits and pieces of choice, but if you don't have treatment, you will die. And that doesn't really feel like a choice. I did make some choices. I chose to have a reconstruction. That's been a choice I've wrestled with, because it's not been an easy recovery from that. And I try not to use the word regret, but I think I'd have made different choices with some of my treatment. And one day, it was a beautiful day, last autumn. There's a quality to the light at this time of year that touches on the surreal. The gold, amber, burnt ochre tones make me ache for something I can't quite place. Seeing this landscape I love, bathed in sunshine as it is now, makes me pulse with loss. There's a permanence about all these hills and lochs, and coming up to a height so I can line up my own impermanence alongside them is the greatest leveller I know. I feel so very small. I almost consider turning back, wondering if I'm in too sharp a mood, but I press on, skirting the hill in search of a path that will give me a way to climb up higher still. I've a yen to peer over the top to a Briachen. As I walk, I play with each step in my mind, silently mouthing, I choose you, and you, and you. But it was only in the thinking back to that trip up this hill and writing it, and in my mind remembering that I took these paces one by one that were chosen paces, it was only in that I remembered that at the top of the hill I sat there and suddenly thought, I can't choose the weather on this beautiful day, and I can't choose to have or not have cancer. There's some things that you can't choose that aren't part of choice. And so if you wrestle with those, you're just on a hide into nothing. There's no point. There's no point raging against the sky for a cloud going over the sun. And there's no point in me raging at my body for getting cancer. I check my watch, swithering on whether to push on a little further or turn for home. I figure I've got 20 minutes more. So I turn off the path and push up through the heather, grasping at tufts to pull me up a sharp rise till I come to rest by a stunted, wind-bruised pine standing on its own. We've seen better days, this pine and me, but here we are, still standing in spite of what's flung at us, up on top of the hill on this glorious day. I feel a tenderness towards it. The sun hovers just over the brow of the hill, spilling onto the bracken, setting it ablaze. Hunkering down to eat my cheese and apple, I look along Loch Ness to Loch End Beach, following the line of the river, then canal with my fingertip, narrowing my eyes to squint as waters flow into the Murray Firth and, in the distance, to where they wash the sands of Nairn, then Findhorn. Maybe, if I go back in my mind and take this same finger and retrace, revisit, replay the decision-making processes connected to my cancer, I can reposition them to feel less jarring and jagged. That was quite a big moment for me to realise, actually, stop feeling so imposed upon, realise and settle with the fact that some things we simply don't choose. I like this thought. It feels like it's been sitting up here, waiting for me to climb up and find it. So I pick it up, wrap it carefully in my hand, and put it in my pocket while it's still warm. Then I turn and make the choice to head back down the hill and home.
Kind of get the feeling we're heading for the big reveal at the moment, because we're just still making our way through this birch woodland. And you can see these fiddleheads, a bracken coming up, which are great. Lots of moss, lots of lichen on the trees and things. It's a clean atmosphere over here. And that wee beach down there on the Loch Shore, it's just glorious. How beautiful.
There was a day when I was having a tough day. I was just hating it all and feeling so frustrated with my lot and trying not to feel sorry for myself, but failing. And my back was dreadful and everything just felt... Ugh! I've shed quite a lot of tears in these woods, and I came up here to have a good cry away from the house. And as I walked through the woods, I saw all this gold dotting through the woods, and I suddenly went, chanterelles. There's chanterelles everywhere. And there's something where nature can totally remove you suddenly from the place you're at. And I saw all this and went, wow, I've got to go back for a basket. I've got to come back up and pick mushrooms. And it transformed the day.
You were talking earlier about the fact that it's been so difficult for you accepting the physical aspect of it all, with the cycling particularly. Has anything good come out of this?
Right from the get-go, and I mean within hours of my diagnosis, I decided that cancer came with a gift. And this is my interpretation of it. I can imagine lots of people listening and going, a gift? What? Cancer gave me the gift of knowing suddenly what mattered and what didn't, who mattered and who didn't. It throws all the stupid little things you worry about just vanish. I described it at one point almost as being like this superpower. And I said, if I could bottle that and give that to all the people I care about and say, here's how to know what matters. Here's how to not sweat the small stuff. It was instant. It was like a switch being given to me. So it was a really good thing to come out of it, because I think I live differently now. I try to live without sweating the small stuff so much. I try to put things into perspective more. So that's certainly one of the things to come from it. And you know the other thing to come from it? I'm not one to lean on others terribly heavily.
You know your own mind.
I know my own mind. I'm very independent. And so I don't think that I've ever been that aware of the value of other people's support in my life and how much friendship and love and family can genuinely bring you. After my diagnosis, the feeling of people just welling up around you and literally holding you up when everything had buckled was incredible. And I had never acknowledged that before.
I think if you are strong, if you're competent, if what's in your head is, I exist here to help other people, Yeah, I am strong for other people. I will do things for other people. And all of a sudden you find yourself in a circumstance where other people are helping you. There's a period there. It's extraordinarily difficult just to let go of your previous sense of yourself and say, "Ah, fine, okay, help me. I'll take it."
It's a bit like the honesty thing. It's a release. It's a giving of yourself, and giving people permission to help you is changing the nature of that relationship. But actually, it's just a really important thing to learn to do. And I don't think I've ever valued people and relationships more. And yet, Helen, you said, is there been other stuff good to come from it? Whether it's good or not is a moot point. For me, it's been beneficial. It's been the writing. Because I didn't write before. And that's been a source of great solace and joy and creativity. And it's something that's come to me that I can do without having to be physical, without having to be on a bike, a kayak, walking, running. Because you're right, I don't stop much. It's something that rewarded me for sitting and being.
I know this may seem like a ridiculous question, but there may be people listening to this who've had a cancer diagnosis. Is there anything that you would say to them about how to deal with it, having had this experience?
I think I'm still dealing with it. So it's ongoing. It's such an individual thing, an individual experience. I've had to find my way of dealing with it, my way of processing it, which does involve this landscape very much. And I can't imagine how I'd have dealt with it without having this. But then I'm someone who processes through moving and doing, so though this has just worked for me. I wouldn't want to say to anyone, "You're going to be fine." People always say that to you when they hear you've got cancer. "You're going to be fine. It'll be all right." You know, because no one knows if you're going to be fine and it'll be all right. And I didn't find that helpful. And people say, "Just be positive." Positivity helps. And I'm sure it does. But you know, there's days when you're going to feel absolutely rubbish and you're allowed to feel negative too. So don't beat yourself up for not being positive all the time. I think I would say try and find the things that work for you to give you a bit of peace from the fear that you'll be going through. And if you're lucky enough, like I was, to have those friends and family around you who are prepared to hold you up and wrap themselves around you while you go through this, lean into it. If you're absolutely in the thick of it, I'd just like to, you know, everything changes. Nothing remains the same. So hold on, and things may feel different in an hour, in a day, in a week, in a year, like I've had. But nothing stays the same forever. So however bad you might feel right at this moment, hold tight, because change is always happening.
Penny Latin there. And thanks to her for sharing her experience of cancer recovery with us. If you'd like to find out more, look up her blog at pennylatin.co.uk. That's Penny Latin, all one word, PennieLatin. If you'd like to share your thoughts on this, then you can email us at outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. Until the next Scotland Outdoors podcast, from Penny, Helen Needham and myself, Mark Stephen, thanks very much for listening.
I've been given a little pass to paradise for a bit. I'm just a blink in terms of the timescale of all this. So this landscape and where I fit into it, it just reminds me that I'm fleeting. But I think it also serves to constantly remind me to value it and value what fleetingness, if that's a word, we have.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.